You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. In her debut novel, Suns and Other Flammable Objects, writer Poro Chistokhapour gives us the lives of the Adam family, Iranians who flee the revolution in their homeland to make a new life in the United States, ending up in a Los Angeles apartment complex called Eden Gardens. But as any immigrant can tell you, paradise is not so easily found or left behind. Poro Chistokhapour was barely 3 years old when her own family left Iran for this country in 1980, and she has woven details from her own observations into the story of the Adams, father Darius, mother Lala, son Xerxes. The adjustments all three have to make, first to 1980s California, and later to post-9/11 New York, are just part of the tale here, which also examines the conflicts between fathers and sons. Poro Chistokhapour joins us here in the studio to talk about Suns and Other Flammable Objects. Hey, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we know that names and labels, what we call things, are important in all novels, of course, but with an immigration tale, they figure especially large. Let's start with the Adam family. What happens to their names when they arrive in this country?
Well, they all have to make some decisions in regard to their names. Darius, his name is, of course, Dariush in Farsi, and he goes back and forth on whether or not he's going to have it be pronounced as Darius or not. He sort of lets them Americanize it a bit, but the straw that breaks the camel's back is when the mother, whose name is Lale, decides to go by Lala. She decides that that would be a more California-appropriate name. And, of course, L.A. being La La Land to many, I had fun with that. But I sort of had an obsession with all the names in this. Adam isn't even a Farsi last name. It's actually just a play on the word for mankind, Adam or Adamizad. So there was a lot of toying with names here.
Speaking of toying and having fun, what prompted you to move them into Eden Gardens?
Well, the truth is the setting of the novel is very similar to the apartment complex where I grew up in, which was called Tropical Gardens. And I was tempted to play with some, of course, biblical imagery in naming it Eden Gardens. I sort of have Lala fancying her Eden's Eve. And there's just tons of wordplay throughout the novel. I'm sort of, I guess, a language writer, and I'm interested in that.
Well, in fact, Lala, when she is trying to use an American phrase for letting go of the past, what does she say?
She goes, we've come to America to lose our minds. You know, that's sort of her way of dealing with all the things she loves in America, from Disneyland to Las Vegas. She likes the sort of manically optimistic American life in Los Angeles, particularly for that reason.
Now, who of the three is having the hardest time adjusting to life in America?
Well, the father, Darius, it's very awkward for him because he's still considers himself an Iranian. He really refuses to see himself as an American. But more than everybody, basically the son, you know, Xerxes suffers probably the most more than anybody else because he, you know, is absolutely lost, torn between the worlds of his father and his mother and then the kids at school and everybody in between. So that ends up being...
Well, in fact, you, I would assume, know what the particular challenge is if you are the young generation who has to sort of be the standard bearer, if you will, for the newly arrived family.
Yes, definitely. It was very awkward for me as a child coming to this country, and it sort of still never ends, you know, now with Iran more than ever in the news. I guess I got the 90s off, but now it's back more than ever. So I still have days where I feel like, wow, yeah, I'm an immigrant in a way that I felt when I was, you know, 4, 5, 6 in an elementary school for sure.
What does a 6-year-old make of the immigrant experience?
Well, for me, what was tricky was, you know, we left Iran when I was around 3 years old, and then we traveled through Turkey and through many European countries until we finally settled in our small suburb outside Los Angeles. And, you know, I had to actually learn English on the playground of preschool and kindergarten, and I still remember learning English through hurling back the insults that were thrown at me from other kids, because I was this sort of overly dressed up immigrant kid. And, you know, I'd look different, I acted different, and so I would just imitate all the other kids. And so I'm very cognizant of that sort of experience of learning English and also being a foreigner. Those memories are very, still very much with me.
What sort of insults?
Oh, I remember I learned retard very early on to my parents' horror, and shut up was a bit of a staple. Yeah, those were, you know, and just a lot of hateful things. It just took forever for me to sort of learn English properly. But when I did, I became completely obsessed with it, and here I am, I guess.
We're talking to Borchester Kokpor. Her debut novel is Suns and Other Flammable Objects. And, of course, if you want to find out more, you can go to WNYC.org and look at our show page. Would you read us a little bit from the
sure.
book? And set it up for us. What are we going to hear?
Yeah, this is somewhat at the beginning of the novel. This is basically the father goes on this eccentric crusade in their apartment complex to put bells on all the neighborhood cats' necks, because there's all these blue jays in the complex that have been dying. The cats have been preying on them. And so this is sort of one of the first memories that Xerxes has of his father being even more different than even the foreigner father. And it's sort of the onset of this anxiety that will follow him through his life. Okay. Xerxes especially felt his father's pain when he'd witness him coming home from work those evenings, suddenly less lazy-eyed and dazed from overwork, but instead disturbed and jittery at the doorway, rushing to wash his hands, then sniffing them, shuddering, biting his lip, looking downright rabid. Those were the signs that his father had just discarded a dead one. He did the deed only once in front of Xerxes on the way to school one day when Xerxes came within inches of a dead bird. "Stop!" yelled his father, shoving him into a rose bush. Xerxes, furious, saved himself from mass pricking and watched as his father yelled, "Don't watch! Turn around! Run to the car!" His father, meanwhile, crouched down, as usual, totally unversed in child psychology, telling himself his child had done just as he said, looked away or left. And he reached into his pocket and pulled out a ready plastic baggie. To Xerxes' horror, it was the same type of Ziploc bag that had his beef cutlet sandwich in every day. His father, by this point, was always ready for the reoccurrence of his waking nightmare with a few baggies at all times in his pockets, plus a scooping instrument Xerxes also knew well, the plastic spoon. Again, to Xerxes' horror, the same make and model used for the shoveling of his pudding snacks, also in his lunchbox. He watched, mesmerized, as his father directed the bag's open mouth wide, sighed a few times, and with a trembling spoon scooped the messy, bloody mass of feathers and disjointed bones into the bag. "Run, run!" his father yelled when he finally discovered Xerxes spying behind him. And Xerxes would run as fast as he could, past the car, past the dumpster, where his father would mutter some curse like an anti-prayer and drop off the anti-sacrifice, past the corner and all the way to the next street where his school would be in sight about a half mile away, and then maybe all the way to the next corner, wishing there was a way to get lost, get really lost in his one and only hometown, or farther, always thinking bigger, frantically scheming until the honking and flashing lights of his father's Dodge Omni hatchback would corner him at the curb, and he'd breathlessly, shamefully get into the car, both males silent and awkward, ashamed of it, of that, and of everything between them, or missing between them, until they'd get to the schoolhouse, grumble goodbyes, until suddenly Xerxes was free to hop out, skip out, in fact, suddenly relieved to see the people other than his family and his world.
That is Borchester Kokpor reading from Suns and Other Flammable Objects. You write at one point that there were, in fact, many immigrants living in Eden Gardens. And here's a quote from the book. "The foreigners lived their old lives each family thinking they were the only odd one out. What sort of isolation are you talking about there?
Well, you know, you take a place like Los Angeles, it's supposed to be very diverse and progressive, but in an apartment complex like the one I grew up in, you could really see all the foreigners in their, you know, respective boxes, kind of, literally, you know. Nobody really mingled. No one had English as their first language. And there wasn't that sort of, diversity catalog picture of all of us in the yard hanging out. So we all kind of would eye each other suspiciously, and there was no communication. And sometimes when you get to school, it was even worse. So I definitely recall that feeling for sure.
Talk about the role of TV.
Yeah, TV is big in my novel. Pop culture in general is big because I was a pop culture journalist originally. But definitely Barbara Eden makes more than one cameo.
I was going to say, I Dream of Jeannie. What were you up to?
You know, I was always very fascinated with I Dream of Jeannie as a child because how could I not be? I mean, a platinum blonde Jeannie is sort of very amusing, I would think, to all Middle Eastern kids. But especially me, I was fascinated by that show. And I generally like to put in celebrity cameos as much as possible in my fiction. And, so Xerxes, like myself, grew up with a sort of fascination with Jeannie. And she pops up throughout the book in very different ways, from dream sequences to the controversy with his parents about him watching that show too much.
At one point, Xerxes refers to Iran as his anti-home. How similar is that for you?
Well, I've had to come to terms with it. You know, I originally never really wanted to write about Iran. When I was in grad school at Johns Hopkins, I remember my instructor, Alice McDermott, always telling me, write what you know, it's not the worst advice in the world. And I used to refuse to. I would write all this highly pretentious math and science lit, if you will, sort of stories about chaos theory with lots of footnotes and you know, sort of metafiction of the 90s.
What was behind that resistance?
I had, in my household, much like Xerxes' household, I was politics. It was all around us. It was dinner time conversation. Every argument between my father and mother had to do with politics. Everywhere in our house there was an Iranian flag, photos of ancient Iranian art to photos of the Pahlavis, you know, and it was just constantly, I just wanted to feel like a human outside of nationality and ethnicity, and I was never able to do that as a child. So it was a strange decision for me to come to writing a novel about Iranians.
How do you balance that with the fact that Iran is so much in the news? Do you feel how much do you feel a responsibility that, oh, no, I have to present it a certain way, I need to correct any misconceptions?
Sure, yeah. When the book came out, actually, I think it was in the same week, my technical pub date, as when Ahmadinejad came to Colombia to give that notorious talk. So I was like, oh, God, great. You know, Iran's all over the news. In a way, okay, interest in Iran is high, so maybe that's good for my book. But I was also just a bit mortified at the whole thing. And then I was in those early readings I did in some of the early book clubs, most of the Q&A period would be all about Ahmadinejad. And I was like, oh, my, I'm a 29-year-old novelist, you know, not a politician. I don't even have a political science degree. I don't have too much to say about it. And then they would say, but isn't your novel also about 9/11? Certainly this is a political novel. I guess I can't completely deny that. But for me, I was more interested in the personal and the universal rather than the political. And I think that's an important distinction to make. And I answered those Ahmadinejad questions. I mean, after a while, I started getting so flippant about it. I started saying, you know, I felt like a pop star where they're asking you about your ex-boyfriend or your ex, you know, and I was like, I never went out with Ahmadinejad. He was not my ex. I can't give you any insights into that guy's mind. I probably feel very similarly about him as you. I'm bewildered, you know. So I'm still kind of dealing with how to but I also feel like I should talk about it a little bit and give my thoughts on it. So I do now. I sort of compromise. I give a disclaimer that this is not my area. I'm a novelist, but I'll go there a bit with people.
Parachista, we have run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Parachista Kakpour. Her debut novel is Suns and Other Flammable Objects.